Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to It Happened in Hollywood. On this week's episode, we go back in time 50 years to the Best Picture winner of 1974, plus six other Oscars. All that on this week's episode of It Happened in Hollywood. Hi, this is Seth Abramovich, senior writer at The Hollywood Reporter, your host on It Happened in Hollywood, and we have something very special lined up this week. We have not one guest, not two, but three Hollywood legends in the house. They are Michael Phillips, producer, Tony Bill, also the producer, and David S. Ward, screenwriter of The Sting, one of the most classic heist, well, not heist, one of the most classic con comedies of all time. 1973, it was a blockbuster film. It ended up winning seven Academy Awards, and it went head-to-head with another blockbuster, The Exorcist, for what was the Barbenheimer of its day, as one of my guests so hilariously will put on this week's episode. Please, if you don't mind, sit back and relax, and you will go back to a world of Paul Newman and Robert Redford in the classic, The Sting.
You picked him clean. You never missed him.
Remember that Sting experience? How good you felt? Now, The Sting, winner of seven Academy Awards, including Best Picture, is back.
Hi, and welcome back to It Happened in Hollywood. This is a really exciting moment for me. We have not one, but three very esteemed guests here. I can't even believe we did this, but hello, guys. Welcome.
Hello, Seth.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
And so let me introduce everyone to you. We have Michael Phillips, a producer of great renown. We have David S. Ward, a screenwriter of great renown.
Director.
And director. And we have Tony Bill, another producer.
Who'll do anything.
and director as well.
And what brings these three together? Just a little movie called The Sting. Probably one of the most legendary movies in Hollywood history. A huge Oscar winner. And it was exactly 50 years ago. Last night was the Oscars. And I imagine that brings up memories for you guys, since you really kind of stole the night. So what do you feel on Oscar night? Does it come back to that big Sting night for you?
Not for me, it doesn't. I think that the venue and the audience and the movies are so different today that it doesn't resonate the way you might expect it to.
And what about you, Michael?
No, I had a flood of memories of that evening and went by in a blur, but...
Well, luckily, it's been committed to record by your ex-wife, who's no longer with us, Julia Phillips, who wrote the runaway bestseller, You'll Never Eat Lunch in This Town Again, which is, I think, my favorite Hollywood book of all time. It's an incredible book. Well, I don't know where you stand on it. Were you pro?
I have issues, but what can I say?
She really didn't hold anything back. So,
yeah.
But the prologue to it is actually Oscar night, which is quite amazing. The whole limo ride to the awards, the moment of, you know, what it's like, the surreal out-of-body experience of getting up there and experiencing it, and then everyone wanting to get near you after winning Best Picture. So, I mean, it's been experienced by so few people. The way, you know, Christopher Nolan's wife said, you dream of this all your life, and then it's there. And is it everything you wanted it to be?
For me, it was unreal. You know, I had thought about preparing some remarks, but they just sort of went out the window. But as the evening wore on, it became obvious that we were going to win. It was a two-horse race, mm-hmm. Sting versus The Exorcist. We were winning all the big ones.
Started with me. Actually, I think I was incredibly surprised because I didn't know anyone enough. Tony and Michael were pretty much, and Julia were pretty much it. And the writing award was fairly early in the night. And I think when we won that, I mean, when we won that, that's when I thought, wow, we have a chance to win. they gave it to me and nobody even knows me. I mean, hopefully they're voting for the work, but
no, they voted for you as a person.
No, they did not. But I was such a newbie, a rookie in the whole business that I really didn't know how it worked, and I hadn't prepared any kind of a speech, and I sort of rambled through something. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I forgot to thank almost anybody. I was so freaked out to be up on the stage, and I was just trying to find, well, and these lights are shining in my face. And I said something like, I'm grateful to everybody, but I didn't mention Redford or Newman or George Roy Hill. You know, when I think back about it, and I thought about it again last night because it was the 50th anniversary, I thought, you know, if I were ever lucky enough to win one of these again, the first thing I would do is thank them and then thank
right.
Thank whoever, you know, I was involved in the movie that I was doing now.
Well, also, like Michael just said, as the evening wore on, I shared that impression with him, at least, because it kept stacking up wins in, so to speak, minor categories. By the time the Best Picture Award comes, it's the very end of the evening. And what I remember most vividly about that is not only not preparing a speech, but being hustled off the stage, on and off the stage. It's the last thing. And they were very conscious of the time in those days, maybe less. So yeah. So the timing was everything, and they were, as usual, running over schedule. So I remember us being, you know, pounced on by some producer or something saying, make it short, just get up there and make it short and get off. And so I just felt obliged to make it short. And so,
yeah, I don't think we had that. I don't remember us having that whole thing where everybody's on the stage together.
No.
Because you guys got, you know, as the producers, you got the award for Best Picture. And then usually at the end of the show, the rest of the cast and crew that's there come up and you have this sort of reunion on stage. But I don't remember any of that. I think it was actually, I wasn't still backstage, but, we just went and met each other at the dinner.
I remember it was a moment when we were announced as winners and Julia got her necklace caught in the arm of the chair. It was a moment that she was, I could read her mind. Fuck that necklace. I'm going up there. I don't remember how it was resolved, but calmed her down, disentangled the necklace.
Speaking of the drive there in the limo, I remember one song that was playing, and Julia was very, very upbeat about us winning. And none of the rest of us, we all thought, well, okay, fine. And Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl was playing. And every time I hear Cinnamon Girl, wow, I think of that night.
Wow.
I remember when we were given our award by Elizabeth Taylor, and that was just after The Streaker.
Right, which they parodied last night.
Yeah, very well. But I remember, you know, first of all, she's Elizabeth Taylor, and I'd never seen purple eyes like this, and here she is. And the first thing she comes over to us, instead of saying congratulations, she says, "Was I any good? I was so unnerved." And she was completely wrapped up into how herself. Well she did. Yeah, not a single word of
welcome
congratulations.
To Hollywood.
She probably didn't even see the movie.
Do you remember The Streaker? I mean, who could forget The Streaker? But that must have been a moment.
It was so fast.
Also, it was a thing that year. There was streaking at sports events. There, you know, it was just a thing. Right. So it wasn't a complete surprise.
But David Niven handled it.
He did.
Yeah. He was pretty cool about it.
All right. So that's fun to start with the Oscars since we're in Oscar season. But let's go back in time and talk about The Sting. I've seen it. It was my father's favorite movie. I've seen it many times, but I watched it again yesterday. And what an incredible movie. This is probably one of the best motion pictures of all time. I mean, it just has that feel to it of it'll be eternal.
Well, thank you. I hope you're right. One never knows.
In my mind, there's certain films like Chinatown and Sting that are just, it's like what you want Hollywood to go back to, and it just doesn't seem to want to. But now how something like this comes together is so interesting to me. The word slush pile came up when I was researching it, as in this was a script that you had written. You were, like you said, not established at all. And it was discovered just in a giant stack of... No. Is that wrong?
No, that's wrong.
That's very wrong.
All right.
Very wrong.
Okay. So let's correct the record. You tell me, how did it come to be, to be discovered?
Well, we had done a movie previous together.
No, go back earlier, that even before.
Why
do you mind
you,
if I go in?
Yeah, you should tell it because, no, you okay. tell it because, yeah, and I was such a rookie. I didn't know what was happening after.
My memory, which may be off, but my very brilliant partner, Tony Bill, made the observation, gee, here we are in Hollywood and we have all these talented graduates from film school and they can't get arrested. They can't get their scripts read. They can't get interviews because Hollywood was, you know, it's like, I played Little League. I want to try out with the Dodgers. So, but he said, gee, wouldn't it be great, you know, if we had some, a fund and could get in business with some of these talented writers who are knocking at the door. And he spotted several and we started to look together. Then one day, Tony on the West Coast, Julia and I on the East Coast, Tony said, a guy came into my office and pitched me an idea, and it's so good, I made an audio tape of it. I want to send it to you.
That's pretty close to correct.
And that's, you know, and we played it. And I mean, David was laughing at, you know, it was so interesting and he was so into it. And he said, I'm not going to tell the ending, but it's going to be a con on the audience.
I don't think he told us that much. As far as I remember, you just said, and I'm not going to tell you the ending.
Okay.
And I said, that's good enough for me.
And we said, okay. And we had a bankroll. We had a bankroll of $3,500 or $4,500 between the two families. And we said, can we see a sample? Can this guy write? And he showed us Steelyard Blues, his film school thesis. So we boldly put all our chips on the table and said, we want to pay David to write this thing. We also want to option Steelyard Blues. And that's how we got into business.
That's where it started. Yeah.
Came into being first. So the writing of this thing was delayed a year. But that's the business side. But the creative side, David, how did, you know, I think it's really interesting how you discovered this world. And
where did you go to school, first of all?
I went to Pomona College as an undergrad. And then as a grad, I went to USC Film School.
Okay.
For a year, but I couldn't afford it. I tried to work a job while I was going there, but I still couldn't afford it. So I transferred to UCLA. So I graduated from UCLA, although USC still claims me as a graduate from time to time.
especially when it's
time for alumni donorship. I graduated from UCLA, and my thesis film that I wrote at UCLA was film called Steelyard Blues. But how I discovered the idea for this thing was when I was writing Steelyard Blues, I had a pickpocketing sequence. And I'm not a pickpocket, so I don't know how to do it. And so I tried to do, I did a lot of research on pickpockets. In researching pickpockets, I also, you know, found some material on confidence men, because anytime you had a book that talked about grifters, at the top of the grifter scale were the con men, and at the bottom were the pickpockets. So I started reading about confidence men, and I just thought, God, these people are amazing. It's like they put on these little dramas. They set up a situation where they can actually run what feels like a high-stakes play. And I'd never heard of this particular criminal subculture before, so I thought, God, this could be a very interesting script. That's when I took it to Tony and Michael, and because Tony was out here, so I made the tape with him. And, you know, I had put together a bit of a story. I sort of hit, it was about 5 minutes of what confidence men were about, sort of the basic lay beats of the story. And then I said, but I'm not going to tell you the end.
Did you know the end?
Well, that's a good question. I thought I did, but the end changed as I wrote the first draft. Because once I got to writing it, I wrote a first draft and I wasn't happy with it. It took me about 6 months, and I thought, well, it's about a confidence game, but what I wanted to do is be a con on the audience as well, so that they can't say at the end of the movie, well, I would have never fallen for that. So started over again, not started over, but started rewriting it. Took another 6 months, and when I got the idea about the fake FBI, then I knew how to get to that ending I wanted. And that really cracked the whole thing open for me.
I wish I still had that tape. I think it would be fun.
I would love to hear my.
Because I remember it pretty vividly that Stu Miller, David's agent at the time, called me and said, I'm sending you a script by a young writer. Since you seem to like new writers, which I had produced Terry Malick's first script. And so I read this script, Steelyard Blues. And I said, I love this script. It's just, I love the talent of this and originality. I'd love to meet him. And so David comes to meet me and I say, this is blah, blah, blah. This is great. I love it. What do you want to do next? The same question everybody asks us even today. And he said, well, I had this idea about a movie about con men in the 30s, about a young guy that gets his best friend gets killed by a con man. And he decides he's going to go after him and con him out of every dollar he's got. I remember vividly that was the, so to speak, pitch. And basically, that was all I needed to hear. I said, I love it. I'll see if I can put together financing for this. And that was that. And I said, while we're at it, put it on tape so you don't have to do this all over again for somebody else.
Well, you had me put it on tape because you were going to take it to Redford.
And exactly. I was going to take it to whoever, Redford, if he was interested.
I think you were going up to Sundance to talk to him about Great Waldo Pepper or something.
That was later.
Maybe.
Yeah, that was after.
You said you were going to take it.
But I had met Julia in New York.
Ah.
And he was part of that group, of that company, First Artists.
Yeah.
And so I said, I'm going to New York for some reason or another, but I've met a young woman in New York, and I think she's smart. I think she'll like this. And when I got there, we talked about Michael, and she said, my husband is in the finance. I said, great, bring him along. So the three of us, as Michael said, with three of us optioned the first script and commissioned the second one and waited, so to speak, for both.
How did you know Robert Redford?
I don't remember. It was very tangential. Mm-hmm. I didn't really know him until we made the movie with him.
But you guys were young, right? Like, you were fresh-faced.
Yeah, I was 10.
It's looking that way.
It was 50 years ago.
Yeah, so that was one of the things that I got out of the book is that you were kids, like you were like you couldn't believe you had broken into the game.
Kids were not welcome in those days.
Right.
I can speak for myself. You know, when I got into the movie business, it was as an actor, and I was 21 years old. And I didn't really want to be a movie star, but I wanted to continue in the movie business as a producer and maybe a director. But we young people were not welcome in the movie business in the early 60s. We were pretenders. You know, we were dismissed, by the way, especially if you were an actor. But that changed until, of course, now you can't get into the movie business unless you're young. So it's a complete change of venue for young people today to be taken seriously. But we weren't. Me and Michael Douglas and other people who tried to change their lives professionally or be taken seriously. We were in beach party movies, beach party bingo movies. That was it.
Is this movie part of the new Hollywood, that whole notion?
Yeah.
I don't agree. I think it's the last gasp of the old Hollywood.
I do.
I don't think that's kind of movie is made. Well,
it's the last gasp of a group of directors who came up together. But there was a whole revolution in the business about young writers writing original screenplays.
And directors, Francis and Billy Friedkin, look at who our competition that night was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was a sort of a golden era for young writers to write. There was no, you didn't have to have any IP or anything else. You just had to have a good script that executives felt somebody's going to want to see this.
It was also the birth of the original screenplay.
Because they were starting to feel they were a little out of touch with that generation.
It was a very fortuitous moment.
Yeah.
Because studios, which were in the business of trying to repeat last summer's success, had a series of big flop musicals. Mm. And they were confused and then along comes Easy Rider and shows you that if you give somebody who smokes pot and has ponytail and give them a little bit of money, it's possible.
Plug
into something. So I really feel, and Peter Biskin wrote a terrific book about this, but Easy Rider opened the door to the studio standing back, letting the directors and young filmmakers do their thing until Heaven's Gate slammed it shut again and they reasserted control. But during that period, original screenplays.
My contention that the original screenplay was an unwelcome guest in Hollywood until right about that time.
Right about
there were some original screenplays and some famous movies that were original, but it created an allure, I would say, for the original screenplay around our
so
time.
Many, so many people started at that time. Myself, Schrader, John Milius.
whole crop of, I mean, like you all said, the 70s, and we hung out together, which was
George Lucas, I mean, and Spielberg and Scorsese started at that time too, even though they weren't writers. But De Palma, just a lot of people, all, you know, at basically the same time.
Same time, writing original screenplays.
And obviously,
and the door
Coppola.
Was the door was open.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a shift away from, it's just a lot of gigantic changes, but directors had been taken from, and writers, from theater, television, journalism, you know, not film school. It was really an amazing time. You go to the movie every weekend, there would be two fabulous new things to see by talented directors. And, anyway, that's my nostalgia for that.
But speaking of directors, so George Roy Hill becomes the director of this, and he's fresh off Butch Cassidy and The Sundance Kid, and he employs a kind of very traditional filmmaking techniques to it, almost like 1930s a gangster film lighting and things like that.
Yeah, he wanted it very much to, you know, with the wipes and the iris outs, and he wanted it to feel very much like a 40s movie.
Yeah, so I think it was the marriage of the old and the new that somehow created something very magical in the film. So how did he get on board?
He had an overall deal with Universal Studios, and they got him the script, and he loved it. And after
That's
scratching...
All it takes.
What?
That's all it takes. Yeah. The movie made...
No, but it took us a few seconds to deal with this, and we were pretty arrogant because we had sold... It was a great, great script. Still the best script I've ever read. And, we were feeling pretty hot, feeling our oats. Well, George Roy Hill, well, maybe, can he do this? But we came to our senses.
Well, he also didn't want anybody to screw it up. You know, when you're dealing with the power of an established director in those days, you're basically throwing your lot in that direction and throwing all your rights and opinions away, mm-hmm. unless they happen to be acceptable to the king. And that behavior was kind of a vestige of the way Hollywood movies got made and were made at the time, unless it was Easy Rider, where, you know, some young guy says, I'll be back when I'm finished, you know, and takes off. And, you know, the studio executives are not welcome on the set. But George Roy Hill, as what you guys said, represented that kind of new amalgam of tradition and us young punks who wanted to make the movie that David wrote. And we didn't want to see it changed into something that it wasn't. So it was a reasonable fear.
It was changed into something different from we thought. And George, in his own words, admitted he's a cornball.
Right. And so, George was also not... George was thought of himself very much as a storyteller. He never went on talk shows or promoted his movies. He was always, he was unlike directors today. He didn't want to be a star himself. He wanted the movie to be the star. And while, you know, working with him, he did change some things fundamentally, but part of it was because of the casting. But we can get into that later. But when we were just working on the movie, he didn't have a lot of... He didn't make a lot of changes in the script.
No, but overall, I remember he used this line to you. He said, David, there will be no runny noses in this movie. Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah, because, you know, in the script, there was quite a bit more emphasis on the depression. And George wanted it to be light. Mm. And bless him, you know. He did a great job, but we had to move from the original concept to...
The original script was a little more, it was rooted a little grittier, rooted more a little in the depression. And the music that I indicated in the script was all blues music from the period.
Interesting.
And George was an accomplished pianist, and music was, he had a PhD in music from Yale. So I was the one who brought him the Scott Joplin stuff. And I brought it to him as sheet music because I thought he might be interested in just playing it on the piano. And when he played it and heard it, he said, no, it's not. This is the music, not that blues music you're talking about. This is the music for the movie. And that kind of expressed the whole change in tone from the script to the movie. And at first I was a little, I just didn't see it. And then when I did see it, then I began to understand what he was doing and got on board with it. But before that, I just didn't know quite where this was going.
Mr. Shaw, we usually require a tie at this table. If you don't have one, we can get you one.
Hey, that'd be real nice of you, Mr. Lonergan.
Lonergan.
Yeah, the film plays like a comedy, just short of a comedy. Mm-hmm. It's not pushing for laughs, but there's a lightness and a funness to it.
Yeah.
And it also really relishes the world of these con men who live in this fantasy world. And in that way, it reminded me a bit of Guys and Dolls. You're with mm-hmm. these underworld characters who all speak the same language and enjoy doing what they do together. So that was George that kind of brought it to that.
Well, it was always, you know, there was always the relationship between Hooker and Gondorf, the two major characters in Newman and Redford, is pretty much exactly the way it was in the script, except in the script, the Redford character was much younger. He was like 19. Mm. And he was sort of a full of himself, off the street kind of con man who had never really done the kinds of sophisticated cons that Gondorf had done. So he was much more a babe in the woods. So had to make a few adjustments in the Hooker character, because obviously Redford was older than that. He wasn't. But still, you know, the way Redford plays Hooker, you know, he gets the biggest score of his life. He blows the money in gambling, you know, a little gambling joint. You know, the way he shows up at the burlesque house with a big smile on his face and his new gaudy suit, mm-hmm. the flowers and everything. So he was still playing it as kind of a carefree young man. But that was a little changed from.
It was a big change. The Gondorf situation, we'll tell the story we've told about that, because Gondorf, Paul Newman's part, is a very second role. Doesn't appear till 20 minutes into the film, only works half of the schedule. And we never thought it was a superstar role. It was a over-the-hill, kind of seedy guy. And George, of course, was friends with Paul Newman from Butch Cassidy. And they would say, here's the script. Here's my next movie. What do you think? And he sent him The Sting. And Paul called him from London and said, this is great. I want to be in it. And he said, I'm sorry. I already cast Bob. He said, no, I want to play Gondorf, which was not at all what we had been talking about. And we actually had to put our heads together and figure out. David's main concern was, after Butch Cassidy, would anybody believe that Robert Redford betrays Paul Newman? Which is, the movie doesn't work unless that happens. And we deliberated, and finally George said, I think I can make this work. And thank God.
Yeah. It's funny. I always felt that Butch Cassidy was Redford's movie, even though they're co-equal. I always felt that The Sting is more Newman's movie, even though Redford has more screen time and is in the movie much longer. But the Gondorf character just dominates the movie.
Yeah. I'm so sad he didn't get a Best Supporting Actor nomination.
I am too. And Redford got a Best Actor nomination.
Redford every day on the set would say, George, I need something to do. I need some character stuff. All I do is run. I'm just a roadrunner.
That's funny.
Well, you know,
he's
being told what to do a lot by Newman. And Newman has, you know, Newman has the card scene. He has
such an amazing scene in the train with Robert Shaw playing Doyle Lonergan, the bad guy.
I think that's the scene that most people remember from the movie.
I'll call.
49. Four jacks.
And that's all Newman.
It's a great scene. Yeah. And it's a scene that defies movie making magic. Five or six people sitting around a table playing cards. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. That is not what you learn in film school to write. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
There's no action. Nobody has a gun. There's no danger.
Most people don't even understand the game.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, what's so brilliant is how threatening you make Robert Shaw's character. So he is set up as such a scary figure that he would get into such a close quarters with him and screw with him the way he does. That's very tense. You know, right away, you're on the edge of your seat. And then the things that he does, it's such an amazing sequence. So cool.
It stands alone. You don't have to know. Yeah. You don't have to see the rest of the beginning.
Just to add in a little side note, that we originally cast Richard Boone, and as production start approached, he stopped returning George Roy Hill's phone calls, Lou Wasserman's, the head of the studio's phone calls, and disappeared in Florida. And reading the tea leaves, we could see he didn't want to do this. So we wound up with Shaw, who nailed it.
Is it true his limp was a real limp?
He hurt, yeah. Handball, playing handball 2 weeks before we started. That's his limp.
That's crazy.
Turned it into a character thing.
Redford also had a fractured finger. You'll see a lot that if you look closely, he kind of holds his thumb.
That's all I see when I see the movie is when he's holding a coffee cup.
Yeah.
I see his broken finger.
Yeah. And a lot of people at the time said, oh, that's an homage to James Cagney. And and no, it was just Redford had this fractured finger and, you know, he couldn't wrap it. We couldn't explain why he had a wrapped finger. So, yeah, we had some walking wounded.
Another thing I wanted to talk about is the women in it. And they both sort of have affairs, but the main relationship is between Newman and Redford. Mm-hmm. When you were writing, did you think that there's no space for a true like love interest in this story?
I didn't, just because I felt like the con was so complicated that we needed to give it proper time so people could understand what was going on or think they understood what was going on so that we could play with their expectations and their understanding. We had to get them to think one thing was happening and then switch them to another. So I just didn't think there was room for a romance in it. I mean, you know, obviously Redford has an evening with Celino, but, you know, she's hardly a romantic interest. Yeah.
That's one of the things that people who go back the second time to see where did he cheat, and by hiding the gender, Celino's gender.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody assumed it was a guy.
Right.
Pretty well done.
But yeah, I just didn't feel there was room there.
And then on Gondorf's side, you have Eileen Brennan.
Mm-hmm. She's great.
Who was incredible. And that whole world of the carousel as a front for a brothel. And it's so, did you dream that up? Is that based
well,
on reality?
Well, I love that carousel. I used to go on down to the pier a lot. And I just thought that carousel was a wonderful kind of, it was a landmark in Santa Monica.
It's also original. It's original to the period.
Yeah.
It hasn't been screwed with.
You shot at the real carousel.
We shot at the real carousel, and before we shot, they were going to tear it down because they were thinking of a whole redevelopment of the pier. And after the movie, people petitioned them to not tear the carousel down because
you saved it.
So it became a landmark in Santa Monica, and it's still there.
That's incredible. Wow.
Those side benefits from the two, a couple of other things that tickle me because one is Scott Joplin, who was buried in a pauper's grave, and after the sting, got his exhumed and given a proper burial.
As was his music. I mean,
and the music was reborn, and the lexicon. I mean, overall, you introduce a language that we've never heard before, but we can get it and understand it all the way through. I mean, that was really beautifully done. And the term sting has endured and entered the language, but in the wrong way. But we have to accept it because the sting is actually the stage of a con where the mark is separated from his money. And it's been turned into an entrapment operation, which is, I don't know, that's the way it happened. But, but it was, it's entered the language. That's a nice thing. It's there.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun when that happens. But some people just take that word for granted now. But it wasn't in any kind of common usage before the sting.
Wow. Just to think that you've had that effect on language, this must be pretty wild.
In fact, as I remember, the studio, as the studios always do, which is appropriate, questions the title of this movie. You know, what does it mean? And one of the objections or one of the points was, it sounds like it's a movie about bees. Or it sounds too much like The Stink. Should we go out with this big, you know, cast movie? Or there's you know, not too late to, the last thing, it's not too late to change in a movie is the title.
Mm-hmm. Did they have options for you?
No, I think we kind of stonewalled it.
Well, it's such a great title.
But there is no title that hasn't been second guessed. And by the way, sometimes appropriately.
Mm-hmm. Ah, but The Sting. I mean,
only now
yeah.
does it resonate.
Is it true Jack Nicholson was considered for one of the roles?
Not that I ever heard. No.
I don't remember that.
It's amazing that all this stuff is out there on the internet and it's like all wrong.
I've heard that. I've heard that.
When I wrote the script, I had Lee Van Cleef in mind for the Gondorf character. But I don't know if we ever even approached him.
I don't think so.
No.
No.
It wasn't big enough.
It was pretty much always Redford circling the project. And then Gondorf was that surprise Newman volunteering. Yeah.
The other aspect of the movie that maybe overlooked more than it should be is that it's really one of the best cast movies that I can think of. The whole spread, the whole panoply of people.
Dana Elkar.
Dana Elkar is great.
He sold it.
Yeah, he did. I mean, the fake FBI. That was really the key.
Yeah.
Also, in the scene where his friend gets killed, Luther, I was like, boy, that looks like James Earl Jones, but it's his father, Robert Earl Jones. I was like, that guy's too old to be James Earl Jones, but now James Earl Jones looks like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That gets the plot in motion, too, because he has a reason to want revenge.
That was what got me about the plot that I said, let's put this on tape, is when he said his best friend is killed by a guy, and he says, I'm going to con him out of every dollar he's got. That, I mean, that is such a sustainable plot device.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about killing to kill.
Yeah. That's another great line.
The first con, which is like a kind of a mini version of the big con.
Yeah, it's what's called a small con.
In the opening?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The worst scene in the movie.
Yeah. I mean,
by George Roy Hill's own admission.
He hated it. The acting was a little over the top. And I being a stupid newcomer, mentioned that to George. And he threw me off the set for the next 2 weeks.
Right.
For, you know, having the audacity to suggest that maybe that scene wasn't up to his level. And then he threw me off and then he reshot it.
In a little bit in his defense, what he said to me is, I'm making mistakes because I can feel David's disapproval.
That's really what was going on.
I can't, you know.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
It would have never occurred to me that someone is confident and
But you're the writer.
Distinguished.
Well, it's also the first week of shooting, the worst.
Yeah.
The first week of shooting on a location out in Pasadena.
He didn't like the way it was shot. He didn't like anything. And the switch is not good, you know. But anyway.
Well, you know, to us, it's not. Yeah, but people watching the movie,
they'll never know.
I'm just glad when we get past it and he's in the cab.
Yeah, once he's in the cab.
He's got toilet paper. Then I sit back and I say, okay we're safe now.
What's so funny?
I just made the world's easiest $5,000.
It's funny that you guys don't like that scene. I love that scene.
It's not that I don't like the scene. It just feels...
It's clunky.
It just kind of doesn't have the right pace. It doesn't quite... I mean, it's not as well acted as it could be, too.
If he reshot it, if he had the time, it would have been better. But anyway... Yeah. How can we complain about anything?
The rest of the movie, the movie's great.
Listen, there's no movie that doesn't have a scene or two in it that the director or the writer or the producer doesn't see what might have been. Whether it started to rain and we had to shoot it past, or has another actor in mind but they couldn't do it. There's no movie, no matter how great, that you can't recast, reshoot, restage, or re-edit something in it that it would make you a lot happier if you could.
Except Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it might be true. I'm not so sure.
I'm sure he got it exactly.
It's just wild to hear something so mutable to me as the film, and you guys are like, well, no, it needs another path.
Well, again, maybe part of that, too, was our expectations about the tone of the film and what he was going to do, because this is the first things we ever saw. But I still... You know, I was pretty much on board with it by the time we started shooting, because although I hadn't seen it with the music, that's for sure. So, but having gone over every scene, we went over every scene in the movie. He was so meticulous, George. He was so meticulous that we went over every line of dialogue in every scene. And he asked me, okay, why is that the character saying this? And, you know, sometimes it was hard for me because I said, well, you know, I'm thinking Yeah, sometimes it's because there's a character motivation. Sometimes it's just because it's a good line. And, you know, I would say that to him sometimes, and he would go, okay, yeah, well, okay. But there was one scene that he never, ever said anything to me about. We never went over it, never said anything. And I said, George, well, how come we never went over that scene? And George, who had a very... who was a very witty guy with kind of a dark sense of humor, said, Dave, I just thought it was hopeless.
Good scene.
I think it was the scene with Redford and the first scene with Redford and Celino in the diner. Yeah.
When he orders the blue plate special?
Yeah. Never went over that scene. I just thought, okay, it's hopeless. Okay.
What's your proudest scene?
My proudest scene? I don't know, probably the card scene, because it turned out to be a much bigger crowd pleaser than I thought it would be, because I, you know, again, I worried about, are people going to understand what's going on? Are they going to get it? Are they going to? But it's full of moments. I don't look at it so much as scenes. I look at it as moments. There's just stuff that's just Ray Walston after he's given the all of the racing reports, and he's just rattling them off. And then the con is over and he just kind of collapses in exhaustion. I just, those kinds of moments in it for me, I just, Billy and the way she deals with Durning and Jack Kehoe when he comes in to audition and Kid Twist says, you got Moxie, kid, get a jacket. Just a lot of things like that, that the actors pulled off that in the script were not big deals, but when you see them on screen, you feel like, yeah, they really delivered there. They really believed and really came through.
Nobody wrote that, right?
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
Happened that way. That's great.
They
made it up.
Yeah, I may have written the words, but I didn't see them really, you know, bringing what they were going to bring to it. And it's just a pleasure for me to watch actors bring something into a whole different level.
And speaking of actors, Newman and Redford, these are two of the most iconic male actors in Hollywood history coming off of their insanely successful Western. And I'm just curious, I want stories. I mean, where were they in their life and what was their relationship like?
Well, I don't have as many stories about that because there was a writer's strike during the movie. And so part of the time I wasn't even on the set. I have some stories with Newman while we were rehearsing. George came to me and said, look, Dave, I'd appreciate it if you didn't talk to Paul about the script because he's very psychological in his approach to things. And he takes anything the writer says to him and he comes to me with it and says, I got this great idea based on what talking to the writer. And then George has to deal with it. And George doesn't really want to deal with it because he says, David, he knows what he's going to do. You know, he just wants to go through everything. He wants to reshuffle the deck 45 times, but he knows what he's going to do. So just don't talk to him about the script. And I'm going, well, what do I do if he comes up and wants to talk to me and says, well, Dave, you know, I'd like to talk to you about the script. I can't say, no, Paul, I can't. I don't really want to talk to you about the script. Well, that would be ridiculous. So I started hiding from him. Every time I saw him coming, I would dart behind any kind of a dumpster. I'd go around the corner. I would just did my best not to run into him because I didn't know what to say. And one day I was watching George talking to Henry Bumstead, the production designer, and all of a sudden, two arms come around me, and I hear this voice say, gotcha. and it was Newman. And he said, Dave, you've been avoiding me, haven't you? I said, no, Paul, why would I do that? That would be stupid. I mean, you're a big star. I'm nobody. Why would I be ignoring you? And he said, because George told you to. He said, so here's what we're going to do, Dave. We're going to have a little conversation because George is right over there, as you know. We're going to have a little conversation and we can talk about anything, you know, baseball, board games, anything you want. And I said, okay, great. And I'm thinking, I'm so screwed right now because George is going to see this. And of course, George did see it. And he came over and he gave me, you know, the original evil eye. And George had one of the greatest evil eyes that you'll ever see. I mean, an evil eye from George was like a harpoon. So I'm standing there, and Newman pipes up, George, great, great you came over. Dave and I have been having such a great, great talk about a lot of interesting stuff, some great shit. Newman looked at him and said, well, what kind of shit? And Newman, to my amazement, started to list a bunch of fertilizer companies, people who make fertilizer. And literally,
that was the great shit.
The great shit. And then he just burst out laughing, and Hill had to laugh. And I mean, that was Newman. He loved making movies. And he gave me some of the best advice I probably was ever given about movies. And he said, look, if you can't figure out a way to enjoy making movies, you won't last, because they're really hard to make. Things happen that strain the patience of even the most patient people. And if you don't know, if you don't find a way to learn to like it and love it, it's just too hard. I thought, okay. And because I hadn't been around many movies, I didn't really know that yet, but I still remember it today. And that's the kind of guy he was. He's a very generous man, great sense of humor, big practical joker. Just, I will never forget him.
Did you read his biography?
No, but I watched the whole thing on TV about he and Joanne Woodward.
That was really nicely really made. Impressive. Really beautifully done.
Yeah. I never read.
It's a wonderful book.
I will now read it because I.
No, and you see that he always felt inadequate, and that he was hired for his blue eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just a very humble, very humble man.
He was.
When I first met him on the stage, first day he was on the set, and he was giant, you know, hero to me. And I was totally starstruck. And he came over and he said, hi, I'm Paul. Great script you got here. I hope I don't fuck it up.
Blah, 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 blah.
Absolutely puddle.
Yeah.
But he was a happy presence on the set. He would bring popcorn, you know, always make jokes, always professional, on time, you know, mock his own mistakes. Oh, Newman, you screwed that one, you know. So it was a privilege, really.
No, it was.
And Redford?
Redford I was less starstruck by because I knew him a little bit. We had a little bit of a relationship. Redford was chronically late. That was the thing. And
never ended either.
But one day, Newman tore him apart for it, and he improved by about 20 minutes. Instead of being 40 minutes late, he'd be 20 minutes late.
What was he up to?
I don't know.
It's a psychological flaw, might be the word, but it's a compulsion to not be on time.
Whatever that was, in all other areas, he was total trooper. No, not a prima donna, you know, nothing, but just this one thing of being late, and it drove everybody nuts. And pretty soon we should schedule around anticipating we're not going to get him on camera on time.
But it wasn't like hours late. He didn't show up.
No,
like,
no,
hungover.
40 minutes.
It was 40 minutes.
40 minutes.
Just enough to be annoying.
Yeah. It comes, I don't know what it comes with. It kind of comes with a sort of star behavior, not behavior. It comes with the mantle of becoming a star, I think. You know, I did a movie with Steve McQueen. Same thing.
But it was interesting to see Paul confront him on it.
Yeah.
Paul was a bigger star.
Yes.
And he said something like, what are you, a movie star? You know? He really said that. And Redford shrunk from it. But anyway.
And he didn't get better with age about it.
No.
He just got later.
No, because you worked on Milagro Green.
Milagro.
It's deeply seated.
On Milagro, I remember one day we were all waiting for, you know, we were waiting at about our call time, you know, we're supposed to start shooting at 7, and it got to be 9:30, and we still hadn't seen him. And then all of a sudden we see this rider and horse riding across a mesa in the distance. And the AD had some binoculars, and he said, yeah, there's Redford. And it was the horse he got from Electric Horseman. They gave him that horse, and he loved that horse, loved to ride it. You know, and it's funny. He came to set and didn't say anything about being late. He sort of, I don't know what he could say, but then he shot, and you know, we went into the day, and the rest of it was all normal and professional. And he didn't play God, or he wasn't abusive to anybody, but he just. He couldn't, I don't know what it was. He had maybe some kind of superstition about being on time. He kept Cheech Marin waiting 2 days up in Sundance for his audition. Hmm. He brought him up to audition him on a Tuesday, and he didn't get to him till Thursday. And he put him up at Sundance in a nice cabin and everything, but Cheech was losing his mind. But that's just... That's Bob. And other than that, he's a great guy.
He's perfect. Yeah, I mean, once he's on the set, you couldn't ask for more. He'll do anything, any number of times.
And he's very prepared, very prepared, and always knows his lines. But Newman is much more, Newman will come prepared with his line, and he'll say it, but then he'll start to work with it. He'll start to do different kinds of things with it. Because Newman... You know, it's just part of his acting style. And it just, he likes to try to find something new, which drove George a little crazy because George is, you know, how am I going to cut this with? But man, that was just Newman. But Bob was really, this is what I got.
You guys have produced a lot of films. How rare is it to have the screenwriter on set like that, possibly annoying the director?
Well, I stopped annoying the director pretty quickly. I stopped even saying anything to the director pretty quickly.
But isn't it unusual to even have the screenwriter on set?
I've always asked the screenwriter to be on the set.
Oh, no kidding.
But I'll tell you, it's very difficult for the screenwriter because, first of all, it's boring. You have nothing to do on the set except sit there and listen to what you already know. Mm. You're the only one on the set without a job to do. And part of your job, so to speak, is you're being invited to be critical, which isn't welcome 100% of the time, and maybe 50% of the time. It's a personality thing. But how many times can a writer come over to a director and say, hey, listen, I really think that you're missing a chance here with that? It's very hard to go back on a set, to go back in time, you know, to like 10 minutes ago or 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. So to be on the set for the writer is probably really difficult for any writer, and not so much so for a director. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I welcome it. It's like having an extra set of ears and eyes, but it's boring.
In Taxi Driver, we expected Paul Schrader to be on the set through production. Then one day he said, you know, I'm going home, like early on. I said, why? Because Marty's making his movie. It's different from mine. And it's time for me to leave.
Yeah. Any movie.
But most writers would want to cling there for the chance to say, no, do it this way. But it was pretty curt.
It totally depends on the relationship you have with the director. On Milagro, Redford wanted me there. As a matter of fact, he doesn't sleep. He gets about 4 hours of sleep a night. He's an insomniac. And he would call me at 4 a.m, say, look, the scene we're shooting today.
He wasn't late for that.
No, the scene we're shooting today, I got a great idea for it. Why don't you do this, this, and this? So I'm up at 4 a.m. writing until, you know, start of production that day on the scene. And then he would come to the set and say, Dave, you know, I've been thinking about it further. I don't think that was a great idea. I think that was a middle of the night idea. I just thought, okay, fine.
But he was late as a director too?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. But he wanted me on the set. Sometimes he would want something rewritten on the set. And I did it. But I didn't ever go up to him and say, Bob, I think you can get more out of that sequence there than you did. I would have never said something like that because that would have booted me from the set.
You learned your lesson on the sting.
Well, yeah. If it's a director that you've worked with 5 or 6 times and you have a very close relationship, then that's different. But I wasn't going to tell George Roy Hill with all of his experience. I mean, I mentioned the first week and learned my lesson. And with Redford, you know, he wanted me there, but he wanted me there for specific things that he would dictate, not that I would dictate.
And what about the notion that they're such like sex symbols? Like, did you have like groupies? Like, I know you shot on the Universe a lot, right? But did that, or did the tabloid press, or did it become like you were under a microscope making the film? Not at all.
It was just another movie at the time, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, but they were looking because this was Newman and Redford.
Yeah, it was on behind closed door. You know, when you shoot on a, especially on the Universal lot, you know, there's a guard at the gate that just keeps everybody off the lot. That doesn't belong there.
And neither Redford or Newman were big on being out in the public and getting any kind of public adulation. They just weren't that type of people.
And there were no cell phones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no internet and no gossipy stuff that would cause people to flock to a location, even when we were on location a few times. I don't think there was any hubbub at all about them being there, was there?
It was really a very punching a clock, you know. Yeah. It was 9 to 5, just met the schedule every day. And
were you keeping the plot under wrap?
No, how could you possibly do that? It's too complicated.
Well, I don't know, in terms of how much you were releasing and what you showed in the first trailer, it seems like you could have a lot of control over what you
never see. Tipped the ending, of course. No, I mean, what we were selling was Newman and Redford and the world of Confidence Men.
I don't even remember the trailer.
Were you saying, don't give away the ending? A lot of movies do that. And so it sold itself, though, right? I mean, this movie was a blockbuster.
Right. It opened Christmas Day.
And the big movie that everybody was talking about at the time was The Exorcist, with the lines around the block.
It's from a, you know, best-selling novel. Everybody knew what it was about. They knew what the subject was. Nobody knew what this was about.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't find this out till later because I didn't – they didn't publish the grosses back then. So you had to be sort of an insider to know what a movie was making. But The Sting, unlike today where you have a movie open at a big number and then a much smaller number the second weekend and then you see how it holds. The Sting held at like $10 million a week for like 6 weeks. I mean, it just, or 7 weeks. It just kept doing the same business. Mm. And that doesn't happen today. And I don't know why it happened then. I guess just because the way people found out about movies and word of mouth and things like that. But The Sting, I think we wound up outgrossing The Exorcist, even though they
at the year, over time, they passed us.
But it was also a movie-going era. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the fading days of it. But people went to the movies. They didn't stay home and watch TV shows. They didn't watch streaming. They didn't really watch movies for television. There weren't any at the time. So it was a movie-going culture. And so now it has to be extraordinary to get you out of the house to go see a movie. And a movie has to open big in order to stay in the theaters, or they'll switch it out for something else. But The Sting kind of earned its way every day.
Hmm. But then, of course, Robert Shaw would go on to make Jaws and then Star Wars, and then you had the whole blockbuster era.
That changed the cultural habit of going to the movies.
Yeah.
And energized the young audience.
Yeah, energized them, and they're more increasingly able to communicate. As you said, the fate of a movie, the business of a movie, was really available only to people inside the movie business who either read the trades or get their information from the distributor. How's this movie doing? Otherwise, did you like it? Yeah, I loved it.
There was a flip-flop.
Reviews, and no more. Reviews no longer hold sway.
Mm-hmm. There used to be, the trades used to publish grosses, but grosses were rentals received by distributor, not theatrical box office, which is about twice that figure. But then when Jaws came along, it started to become newsworthy, and they figured, well, we'll just publish the box office and we'll say it's $100 million, and it suddenly became news. So it's a little bit apples to oranges if you compare grosses from the early 70s to the
interesting.
After.
Yeah, cause I go through the stacks because I do the history page sometimes in the Hollywood Reporter. So we go in the stacks and you see the ads, and it has the number written down.
The number is gross net rentals to the distributor, not the theatrical box office.
So it's much more.
It's a much, it's two different languages. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's also much more current. You know, it's easy to figure out how much people paid at the box office today.
Right.
But to trickle down the distribution expenses, the advertising expenses, all the rest of it, make it a meaningful term, it takes a lot of time.
I'm curious about The Exorcist just because that was the very first episode of this podcast I ever did with William Friedkin, rest in peace. He was amazing. What stories he told about making that film. But it seemed like you both opened around Christmas, right? It really was.
They were the next day. We were in 250 theaters. They were in 12. The news stories were about the lines around the block.
And people fainting and throwing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely a different movie.
Yeah, two different. And when it came to Oscar campaign, it was good versus evil. But they got into some squabbles, public squabbles, The Exorcist people. I don't remember who it was, Blatty and Friedkin or something.
Yeah.
And I think it turned people off, you know, worked to our benefit to some degree. But no, we're forever linked. We're forever linked. They're, it's like Barbenheimer.
Extra sting.
Extra sting.
The stinger cyst.
The stinger cyst, exactly.
Yeah, did you guys like that movie when it originally came out? Yeah.
Blown away.
Oh, it's a great
movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I watched it. Oh, my God. I've never seen anything like that.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I had him show the movie and talk to my class when I was teaching at Chapman Film School. And he drew people from, like, the theater, you know, I don't know what the capacity, but we had 600 people coming from hours away to hear him. He was amazing and generous with his time. He stayed.
It was Blatty?
No, Friedkin.
Oh, Friedkin. Okay. Yeah. Because Blatty died, yeah.
No, Friedkin was... No, I think it's an incredible movie and doing things that no movie had ever done before at that time, and just amazing.
Wow. Well, what a year. I mean, and what an Oscar is just the golden age as far as I'm concerned.
A lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
Did you read Mark Harris's book, Pictures of a Revolution?
I haven't read
that one. Set in 1969.
Okay.
About what we've all been talking about, really, which is that seemingly a moment, obviously much longer, when the baton was passed in the film business from traditional old-fashioned movie star studio filmmaking to revolutionary, young, exciting, inventive filmmaking. And it's a really good book. It's extraordinarily well written.
Okay, everyone should go get it and read Mark Harris's book, who's out there.
It's the best book out there that I know of.
And how did it change your lives, The Sting? What happened after that? Were you the toast of Hollywood?
Really, we all get to keep working.
Best table at Ma Maison?
No, producers and writers don't get recognized or lionized.
Really?
But people are happy to meet with you, but when what you're presenting is not Newman and Redford in another funny comedy.
Right, so what do you want
The Sting too.
I felt a lot of pressure to have to write big movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a movie after The Sting that was a huge Western, because I love Westerns. Huge, big, and, you know, sprawling Western epic.
Railroad?
Yeah. It was called San Joaquin.
Yeah.
Basically about the building of the Southern Pacific Railroad in California and the big land grab that the four robber barons made while they were doing it, and the resistance of people to it, which resulted in a thing called the Muscles Flew tragedy. But what happened was when I finished it and was about to take it around, Heaven's Gate came out and just was a huge disaster. And nobody wanted to make a Western.
Mm-hmm.
So then I just sort of rethought, you know, I'm not going to spend so much time. I've spent almost 2 years on that thing. You know, I'm not going to worry about making big things. I'm just going to do things that I wanted to do. And next thing I did was Cannery Row, a very small thing. So, but we did well for 10 days. People like Spielberg and some other people saw the whole branding thing, the whole becoming a studio in your own, long before people like I did. I never thought about branding myself. I've never even had a publicist. So they started thinking about movies in a whole different way than I did. I kept thinking, okay, I'll just write movies, and if they're good enough and somebody wants to make them, I'll get them made. But that is sort of a passé idea.
You know, this is reminding me, we used to hang out in a group or out at the beach or something.
Your house?
And we'd talk, young people in the business, all we talked about movies constantly, never about grosses.
No.
Zero. And now it's, the conversation is grosses.
Yeah. Well, we were all starting, you know. I mean, I remember Steven was out there. He'd done Duel. Scorsese'd done Boxcar Bertha. He was out there. De Palma, I forget what his first thing was, but we were just starting. Melius, but we always talked about movies. We didn't talk about the money. And even though they were soon to make incredible amounts of money, but we just talked about movies. We didn't think about that so much. And now you can't think about any, you know, you're really looked at as naive in a way if you think about anything else.
The universe of studios, there were 6-7 studios. Well, Disney was asleep. They didn't count. But the others, the creative department would consist of 3 people, a vice president, a story editor, and 1 other person. and then the decision was made higher up. But you give a script, and the decision was made seat of the pants. You know, my daughter liked this script. I think marketing was not even present. They were given a film after it was finished and told, figure out what to do. That all reversed. And now marketing is the decision. Is
the tail that wags the dog.
The tail wags the dog now.
Well, I thought on the Oscars last night, it was interesting when Cord Jefferson won for Best Adapted Screenplay for American Fiction. And in his speech, he said, so he's a newer writer. And he said, look, I know you make $200 million movies because you don't want to take risks, but that's a risk. Why don't you make $10, $20 million movies? And that really resonated with the crowd. And I think people where I was watching it as well, that, you know, those are the movies that will probably last longer in our hearts than these disposable.
Well, the flaw in that comment, unfortunately, is that it costs just as much to release a cheap movie as it does an expensive movie.
With the marketing and all that.
Yeah, especially. Pretty much. I mean, not exactly, but.
Especially because when we were making movies, the foreign market was nothing. We didn't even think about the foreign market.
That's right.
The foreign market today is the first thing they think about because it's bigger than the domestic market for a lot of movies.
Mm-hmm. It's become a business. Yeah. It was not a business. It was a hunch gut playing. We were lucky, guys.
Yeah, we were.
This thing would never have been made if we.
You always today. Wonder with the films that we were able to make if they would make them today.
I don't think so.
And I don't think so.
You know,
Sting would not have sold as a concept foreign prior to its being made.
Because nobody ever made The Sting before. Nobody had ever made a movie about con men and bringing the audience into it and surprise. Even surprise endings were unheard of, whatever the surprise, at the time. And now there's a string of movies that have been made that either have surprise endings or something else was going on you didn't know. The Bruce Willis movie.
Sixth Sense.
Yeah. Sixth Sense.
Well, also just lots of movie. Con artists are the hottest thing on, you know, on streamers like TV shows. And the people love cons. It's an obsession.
Heard of before David's script.
Yeah.
I contend. I don't think in the history of movies anyone ever made a movie in any kind of genuine way about the ubiquitous confidence man.
Well, I salute you guys. You guys are the giants of the movie industry as far as I'm concerned. And thank you so much for coming and sharing these stories.
Thank you. We've enjoyed getting together and tickling our memories. And
we're all still talking to each other. We all know each other.
Yeah, that's nice to see too.
We'll go have lunch and think about all the things we wish we should have said.
Well, you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you, Seth.
All right. Thanks so much. Wow. Thank you so much, Michael Phillips, Tony Bill, and of course, screenwriter David S. Ward, Oscar winner for Best Original Screenplay for The Sting, Oscar winner's Best Picture for The Sting, The Sting, The Sting, The Sting. Such an amazing movie. If you haven't seen it, of course, you got to go check it out now. I'm sure you will be heading straight to your nearest streamer and seeing The Sting. Next week, we're going to keep on the sort of con man theme. And we're going to have one of my favorite movies from the early 90s based on a play from 1990 called 6 Degrees of Separation. And we have in the house the star and Oscar-nominated actress from the film, Stalker Channing, who you might also know from Grease. It's going to be a really entertaining dip into her incredible career and her process. She is a very smart woman. Until then, I'll see you in Hollywood.